The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Manchester City are starting to play like some of the great teams of yesteryear, specifically Manchester City 2017-2019. Does a 5-0 win at the Hawthorns mean the title is theirs? After all, West Brom haven't lost 5-0 at home for 4 weeks now. West Ham are fourth. I repeat, West Ham are fourth. This podcast will now self-destruct. 6 wins on the bounce with completely unspectacular normal man Thomas Suchet carrying them along. Arsenal look quite solid. I repeat, and Newcastle lose again. We'll do a bit more on Thomas Tuchel. Zlatan and Lukaku rut like stags. And Sid tells us why Barca are bankrupt. All that plus your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barney Ronay. Hello.
Hi, Max. How are you?
I am really marvellously well. Thanks very much. Nick Ames, hello.
Hello, Max. How are you?
Yes, as good as I was when Barney asked me. Hey, Mark Langdon.
Hi, Max. I won't ask if you're okay. It seems like you are.
No, you don't care, do you? All you care about is luxurious fat and nothing else. And we'll get into that later, I presume. Let's start at the Hawthorns. West Brom 0, Manchester City 5. There's something, Barney, about... Your hand's up already, Barney.
Well, I just wanted to pick you up on the first thing you said on the pod, that Man City are playing like Man City from 2017, I think you said, which I think is incorrect. And
okay.
Well, I mean, they're getting good results, the same good results, and they look like a really good team. But I think they're playing slightly differently, and that's probably part of what makes it interesting. There's been a lot of talk about them tightening up a bit this season. In that they tended to play in that kind of overloading the flanks kind of way back in that kind of previous incarnation. Whereas now they and there was a certain kind of brittleness that came up at times, but they look really solid now. And Pep Guardiola is relaxed and happy, which is an extraordinary kind of development. I really like this new Pep. I find him really comforting. He's become my kind of lockdown comfort. It's like air stewardesses on a flight, or air stewards. If they're, as long as they're happy and okay, everything's fine. And Pep's doing really well. He looks happy, settled and calm. And that makes me feel good.
There is, although to be fair, in that cup game, he was sort of getting in the way of Bentosa's long throw. When he still has moments when there's turbulence that, you know, he might look he looks slightly edgy.
Yeah, that's true. But he still had both hands on the trolley, and he was more sort of bothered with some problem with a card machine, whereas you probably thought the plane was crashing or something like that. But it's fine. He's just going down the aisle. It's all good.
I do think that I'd see your point. But like when they play like they did in the first half yesterday, it feels like a different sport. You know, it seems sort of otherworldly. You know how Mahrez controlled that ball for his, I think, was that the fourth one? It looked like he was so soft that it could have controlled it with his shin. You know, like there's just something about them. I don't know if you, Nick, you're nodding, so I'll go to you.
Well, I thought it was interesting how Guardiola said maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago that part of their upturn was down to running less, didn't he? And not maybe going quite as hell for leather and just sort of letting the ball do the work. And I think we've seen quite a lot of that in recent weeks. Like they are better defensively, probably a bit more solid than they were 2 or 3 years ago. But I think we are seeing maybe just, you know, people in the right places. It's a bit more intuitive, a bit more instinctive, and the ball's just flowing for them. It's not too hair and scaring. And I thought, like, I if we're talking about first touches, I love the touch by Gundogan, actually, for his first goal as well, the way he's trapped it stone dead, you know. And stuff like that is just coming a lot easier to them now. And I want to say a word for Gundogan, actually, because he's got, I think, 7 in 8 now. And he's always been quite a competent player who filled in and I wouldn't say water carried, but got about the pitch, maybe did some of that running that Pep so detests now and kind of got around. But now he's turned into a kind of David Silva light and also somebody who can pack a punch. And it's quite an interesting regeneration in a player who maybe, partly because he was out for a long time with a really horrible injury, of course, has sort of flown beneath the radar in the last 2 or 3 years, but he's on fire.
Are you saying he's the most underrated Has he taken Mark Albrighton's tag as the most underrated player in the Premier League? Is he the second best midfielder at Manchester City?
He's the most underrated player I've ever seen. No, he's definitely in a groove, and I think he's 30 years old now, maybe in his prime. And yeah, lovely goals he scored, really lovely. Mm. So I think he's been a sort of hidden component behind this last few weeks of improvement.
Speaking of hidden components, Mark, João Cancelo is not someone I've spent a lot of time studying. I mean, is it about time I did a short evening course on João Cancelo?
Well, when you said Man City's second best midfielder could be Gundogan, was you assuming that Cancelo was number one in that ranking, given the position that he seems to be occupying? I'm not quite sure if you were a journalist at the game last night, sort of what formation and where you would have put, you know, in that traditional bit at the bottom where you have to do 4-3-3 or whatever and then do the team lineup, because Man City didn't appear to have sort of set positions really. And Cancelo was one of those really that he was nominally at right back, but quite often was playing in midfield, sometimes as sort of the defensive midfielder. We have seen Pep do that before, sort of tuck in the fullbacks. But he was also playing sort of really high up at times as well, and one of their chief creators. He probably has been Manchester City's best player this season, I think.
I like how you dismissed formations, just 4-3-3 or whatever. Jonathan Wilson absolutely will explode with that kind of dismissiveness. Barney?
I was just going to say, it's been that kind of idea of them being calmer. It's like a transition from Kyle Walker to João Cancelo, who now, like, yeah, you put him at right back because he's generally often replaced Kyle Walker. But you've gone from a guy whose chief skill is sprinting with incredible speed back towards his own goal and bumping someone off the ball because there's been a mistake somewhere. They're brilliant at that. To a bloke who drifts around the pitch just looking like this is just some sort of game in a, you know, in the car park somewhere with a tennis ball, and who's so confident in his own touch and his ability to pass that he's never bothered wherever he is on the field. And that tucking into the midfield to give them that strength there. I remember when Pep did this when he first came to the Premier League, people were sort of outraged by this. What was the right back doing in the centre circle? Which is kind of interesting given that we're now so chilled and relaxed and cool. We're cool with the whole thing. It's fine. Love it. Yeah. But he does it brilliantly, Cancelo, because he's so confident with his ability to play anywhere.
Barney, listeners would be very upset if I didn't come straight to you for the one bit of VAR in this game where Sian Macielis put her flag up perhaps a bit too soon and Cancelo scored while some West Brom players were carrying on and some weren't. I mean, it was quite the controversy. The game changed probably on that moment, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there was some sort of analysis of this afterwards, and I found myself drifting into a kind of reverie, like a waking dream. And then I woke up just at the end as someone said, yeah, but you just play to the whistle, don't you? And that, I think that's probably the end of it, isn't it?
Yeah, probably. I did like how much Hal Robson-Kanu wanted a penalty in the 88th minute, Mark. Like it could have sparked a comeback. I thought that was a real sign of an elite sportsman. Go, come on, we get this one. And then you never know. Run back with the ball under your arm. Stick it on the centre spot and away we go again.
Still 0-0, lads, would have been the cry had it gone in. I suppose, you know, you're just looking to take some crumbs of comfort out of what must be a pretty sort of horrible experience, sort of just running after Manchester City, for 90 minutes at half time. Obviously, the game was up, and West Brom probably thinking about the game they've got coming up against Fulham, which is far more important. But I think from City's point of view, that there was a very early moment when West Brom nearly scored, and it took a big save, and maybe things would have been different. But since that defeat to Tottenham, they've conceded two goals in the Premier League. One of them was an own goal against West Brom, and the other one was that sort of consolation against Chelsea that would have been, you know, very much in that Hal Robson-Kanu sort of penalty sort of department of goals that don't matter.
On a West Brom note, I was interested to learn that Sam Allardyce kept his players in afterwards and maybe had it through with them a bit more than he normally would post-match. And just thinking, they don't look a very Allardycean or Allardycean team, do they, West Brom? I think they've shipped 5 to Leeds at home, 4 to Arsenal at home, 5 now, and they're very, very passive and porous. And Sam made quite a big play of being unhappy with his players' efforts in a big defeat to a very good Man City side. But yeah, something's not quite gone right there, has it? There's not been the big Sam bounce that we would anticipate.
Do you think players react well to being kept in the dressing room for extended periods after a football match? I know it's a good thing to say after the game, I was that angry that I kept them in, but do you reckon they just sit in there and go, look, lads, I've got to keep you in for half an hour. It's just one of the things we do. You know, be on your phones. I won't say anything. Or do you think he read the riot act for an hour?
I don't know. I mean, I've never been inside Sam Allardyce's dressing room. It reminds me of when I once went to the report on the IPL. And the whole point of being there was I'd managed to justify this trip because I was going to interview Michael Lum, who was playing for the Delhi team, whatever they were called. And I remember that I had to get this deadline, like the deadline for the papers. I hadn't spoken to Lum, he'd been playing in the game. And it was a nightmare. I couldn't get hold of him. I was wandering around this chaotic stadium. And I finally found the dressing room. He was being kept in the dressing room by Shane Warne because they'd lost the game and he was being bollocked. I could see Shane Warne going like this, wagging his finger at them. And I had 20 minutes to interview Michael Lum and get this in the paper. And I started texting Michael Lum saying, what the fuck's going on? Why? What's Warne doing? Why? And I could see him getting my texts as I was peering through the window. And he was texting back saying, I'm sorry, Warney's really angry. He won't stop going. And I was giving advice saying, well, look, you've got to get out. Why don't you just start packing it? Well, you know, we need to, I'm sorry. And I could still see Warney wagging his finger at them. And he clearly wasn't really enjoying being held back. And you should probably cut this out for the football podcast that we're doing. The answer is probably no. The answer to the question is probably no. No, they don't.
Okay. Yeah. Let's go to Selhurst Park. Crystal Palace 2, West Ham 3. West Ham in the top four, 3-2, Nick. But it was way more comfortable than that, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I think they hit the post twice, didn't they, West Ham? And I think there was obviously a bit of a late rally from Palace. But no, they look comfortable. And I'm really pleased for David Moyes. I really am. Like, he's not your philosophy manager. But I think after it went wrong at Man United, which wasn't necessarily to his shame, as subsequent events have borne out. There was a bit of an eagerness, wasn't there? I think among quite a few people in the media too, to cast him aside as a bit of a dinosaur and feel a bit disgusted if he was linked with a big job and stuff like that. But he's a fantastic tactician, and West Ham look as good as I remember them. And they're not that dull either. I think they're quite clever, especially away from home, picking their moments to attack and committing men forward, but only when the stage in the game permits it. And I think they do it really cleverly. That balance is there at the moment. And they've got a fantastic player in the guy who scored twice yesterday, Suchek, who I liked in Slavia Prague's Europa League run 2 or 3 seasons ago. But he's got, I think, 7 goals this season now, from the deepish midfield position. And they're often a bit bundled in like yesterday's were. But he's got this knack always when I see him play of getting on the end of something. And that's partly because he's got, he's 6 foot something and, can get his head on stuff and be a presence. But he's clever. He's got timing. And he also sweeps up very well in, the main requirements of his role. And I think if we're looking at one player who has turned things around for them, as well as the manager, it's got to be him because he can do a bit of everything. I think he's good enough for a top four squad, definitely.
Do you? It's interesting. I mean, you're right. Seventh of the season, since his debut in February last year, only Bruno Fernandes has scored more goals from midfield. Who knows? I mean, they're probably all penalties. Fernandes, 19. Suchek's got 10. No player scored more headers than Suchek since he made his debut. But he's kind of, Mark, he's kind of inelegant. He's not quick. He's not that skillful either. You know, he's a sort of, and he seems staggeringly normal. Well, it's probably quite refreshing in a way.
Yeah, I mean, it is probably, if he went to Chelsea or somebody like that, the fans would probably turn their nose up at signing what effectively has become sort of Moyes' new Fellaini in the way that he arrives late in the box and sort of gets his head onto things. And of course, that didn't work out too well when Fellaini was then parachuted up the sort of Premier League pecking order. But I mean, as far as West Ham go. I remember on the opening day, they were beaten by Newcastle. And of course, the two teams have gone in very different directions since. But they were absolutely hopeless in that game. And the season seemed to sort of almost turn around. There was that 3-3 against Spurs with the late goals that really sort of would have been a major boost. But it was when David Moyes was sort of away from the team with the COVID that West Ham started to actually start playing well. And since he's come back, I mean, he as Nick says, has done an absolutely fantastic job of just organising them. And they're not as dull as, say, some of the scores suggest, like the 1-0s against Everton and Burnley. I do quite enjoy watching that front four play.
Well, I had this thought about David Moyes and West Ham last night. The West Ham should probably sack David Moyes because they're too good for him now. That he came in to prevent them from being relegated and to kind of try to put things right. And they've now got a really good squad and they're playing really well. And they're too good for David Moyes. Like, you upgrade other positions, don't you? If you get promoted or if you you start playing the Champions League, you'll buy a new centre forward or we need a better goalkeeper. Like, Liverpool bought a better goalkeeper and they won the league. So why don't we ever do this with managers? The team has now become too good for David. They don't need to be saved. They need to be pushed on. He's done too well and he should be sacked. But I'd like to just say that I totally don't actually think that. And in fact, I'd like to praise David Moyes and say it's exactly a year ago he came out with a statement where he said West Ham signings have been really bad in recent years. We've signed players who've come, who are sort of middle-aged players who've come to plateau at this club. We need to sign younger, better players. And I've got this guy, Thomas Suchek, who he personally scouted. And he went and watched him and said, I know exactly what he's going to do in this team. He predicted his headed goals. He said, this is a bloke we need. He's really good. We're going to buy him because he's the right age. And lo and behold, it's come completely true. And so he has actually affected their policy and he's moulded this team. So maybe he gets to cling on to his job for a few more games on that basis. I don't know.
No, I'm happy to begin the Moyesian circle where he can never quite get up. What are those? Who did those paintings where the staircases just go in on themselves? That's what David Moyes should be. It's just like an eternal life of never quite getting there and just going back.
He's got 3 games to save his job by losing. They need to be they need to be in crisis so they can get David Moyes in.
He's got Newcastle written all over him now, hasn't he? That feels like exactly the right place for him.
Let's go to St Mary's. Southampton won Arsenal 3. Pretty comprehensive win for Arsenal in the end. A game that sort of started brilliantly and then petered out a bit. But Nick, a sort of mature, pretty straightforward win in the end. And that doesn't feel very Arsenal to me.
That's bizarre, isn't it? And I think that's 4 wins in 5 now in the league. And maybe this was the one that actually makes you think, hold on a bit, because you could argue if you were slanted on the pessimistic side of things, that they caught Chelsea on a bad day. You could then say, okay, you've played Brighton, West Brom and Newcastle, and they're not much. But although the signs were starting to appear, especially against Newcastle, I think. But bookending that with a win against a seriously good and serious, impressive Southampton team tells you that maybe things really are perking up. And I think there's always this tendency with Arsenal, isn't there? And it seems to have become a thing in the last 10 or 15 years that the highs are extraordinarily high and the lows are extraordinarily low around their fan base and the expectations when normally the truth is fairly middling. So you don't want to get carried away. But I think, you know, the worst we can say is that they're now getting towards the kind of form that they should be showing week in, week out. And I was impressed last night. I think I went to the FA Cup game on Saturday and Saints deserved to win that completely. They're much more energy. They went hard. Hasn't Hurtle picked a very strong team for that, as he did last night as well, which maybe bit him. They didn't rotate more at the weekend. But what Arsenal did yesterday is they came out and they matched that energy, you know, and I think where it was on Saturday, Southampton stopping them playing out, this time they were stopping Southampton getting out. And players like Smith Rowe back in, Partey back in, Saka, who I think we're going to talk a bit about, hopefully, back in as well, just added to that energy and that pressing and that ferocity that they maybe hadn't had before. And then on top of that, there's a lot of conversation about how Arsenal's squad players aren't actually that good, which I've got a bit of sympathy with. But last night, some of them stood up. Pepe, who's the definition of mercurial, I think, had a good game last night and scored. Lots of dangerous running in behind. Arteta trusted him for the whole 90 minutes, I think, which is fairly rare too. And then Cedric Suarez almost scored against his old club, I think, in the, was it first half with a 25-yarder? And then he unleashed a bit of a ping with 20 minutes to go or so for the third goal. So everyone put a shift in and people stepped up who needed to step up. And I think that's a good sign for Arsenal. And as I say, that's the result in their recent run that would make you think, okay, it's turning.
And Nick, you were very, almost like a sort of Arteta disciple, I remember, when he got the job. How pleased are you for him?
I'm pleased that I've definitely been proved right, incontrovertibly. he did and does need time, because I think we've covered on here before, there's been a lot wrong at that club in the last few years, but there is a sign now that he's starting to get players in the positions he wants to play them in. He's got a few players back and fit. Maybe a few influences who needed rooted out. And it just, there's a bit of an air now of a new broom there that was maybe needed. You know, you've got Ozil, Socrates, possibly Mustafi leaving, Kolasinac, Odegaard almost certainly coming in, maybe today, maybe tomorrow. And then this nice run of form, and it all just feels a lot smoother, a lot sleeker.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Nick, we were talking just before we came on, weren't we, about Saka. Basically, is the manager of the team now. He seems to be the person who's running whatever. All the other players seem to seek his approval, and he's so mature and seems to know exactly what they need to do. And he's got the most like beautiful smile. Like if Saka smiled and told you you'd done well, you'd just feel really pleased. If he said your contributions on the pod were to the point, and I like them. They're even quite funny at times. You just feel great for the rest of the day because you utterly trust his judgment. He seems incredibly mature. There was an amusing incident. Arteta did try to take Pepe off. He didn't trust him for the whole. I mean, he'd run a lot. He was clearly exhausted. He tried to take him off, and then he walked off really slowly because Smith Rowe was injured, and they weren't sure who's going. He got booked for it. by the referee, and you could see him trying to explain, no, my friend's injured, I'm trying, no, book. And then when he finally did get taken off, he ran straight off the pitch so that he didn't pick up a second yellow for the same thing, which is quite funny. But I'd like to point out that Arsenal, Smith Rowe, they always win. When he's played 11 games this season, they've won 9, drawn 1. They've never lost a game when he started. And I don't think that's completely fluke. I think it's because he gives so much in the way of energy and the high press. He's perfect for the way Arteta wants to play.
Yeah, I think Barney's spot on about Smith Rowe. And while it's largely about, you know, how good Smith Rowe is, and he's excellent, it's also about the fact of having an industrious player in that position at all, who will show for a ball, who will let you move through the thirds quite smoothly, who is showing up and putting the yards in. And I think putting Smith Rowe in against Chelsea, wasn't it, kind of allowed Arsenal to kind of transform their style and look a lot less clunky. And I think Odegaard would have a very similar effect, actually, as long as he is match ready.
I think in the interest of honesty, while Barney and Nick were talking about the maturity of Bukayo Saka before recording, I was asking about colon health and whether anybody squatted instead of sat on the toilet, because I've recently been told that's the right thing to do, and I tried it and I found it incredibly difficult. But perhaps that's a different podcast, you know? I could start my own one, colon health, with Max. Let me know if you'd download it. Download seems the wrong word for that kind of podcast. Anyway, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll stay at the bottom or near it with Newcastle United. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Newcastle 1, Leeds 2. 3 lovely goals in this game. Jack Harrison's was sublime. Was it good enough to be sublime, Mark? Is that going too far?
No, you're one of these, Max, aren't you? You just praise Leeds and Bielsa. Everything they do is sublime and brilliant, even if they lose 6-2. It was a great finish. Yeah, I don't think it was as sublime as Newcastle's goal, actually. The Almiron one, which was probably for the first time this season, sort of Newcastle put a piece of play together that they could sort of be proud of as an attacking unit. But this was... I quite enjoyed this game, and I wasn't sure that I would. Last time I was on, Newcastle had just drawn 0-0 with Liverpool, and we praised them quite a lot for that performance. And afterwards, I did wonder if we'd been a bit patronising about them, sort of, good old Newcastle getting two players forward, and maybe we overrated sort of, their attitude in that game, really, because that's what you're supposed to do, isn't it? You're supposed to get men forward and try to score goals. And they did again do that in this game, particularly in the second half. They had 22 shots, five of those on target. But ultimately, this was one of them games, really, where, if you are a Newcastle fan, you look at what Bielsa has done with those Leeds United players and sort of, wish for something similar from an inspirational manager yourself.
Yeah, that's Newcastle's first goal in open play, I think, since Faustino Asprilla scored against Liverpool. Nick, you had your hand raised. How polite.
I just wanted to agree with Mark, really, that, Newcastle fans must watch Leeds because, they're quite desperate to get the Keegan years back and that kind of vibe, at least, aren't they? And they must watch Leeds and think, yeah, that is exactly what we wish we were, that sort of sublime but flawed kind of neutral's favourite style. And they were well beaten. I'd like to say a word actually for Rafinha as well, who looks a good signing, I think, for Newcastle, for Leeds. Good opening goal and a lovely ball for the sublime winner by Jack Harrison.
They've lost six consecutive games in all competitions for the first time since May 2015. Has Bruce got to go, Barney?
Maybe. I mean, I'm not one to advocate like the sacking of anyone, really, but I do. And the only interesting thing that happens with Newcastle now, there's one interesting thing, and it's that someone in the media who used to play with Steve Bruce, and who's clearly one of his friends, says, "I don't know what Newcastle fans want. Steve Bruce is doing a really good job. Their expectation." And then Newcastle fans get really angry about this person saying that, and it goes in an endless cycle. But I'm sympathetic towards them because essentially all they want is some excitement. Like football, they want the opposite of boredom. Steady Premier League consolidation is really, really boring. And that's the opposite of everything that football's supposed to be. They want something interesting to happen that isn't getting angry at a bloke who used to play for Man United saying Steve Bruce is doing a good job. And I completely, the fighting against boredom is quite a kind of noble cause. And I think that they are simply bored by the lack of high emotional peaks in their footballing lives. So, yeah, possibly yes, but it won't happen. And in Steve Bruce's favour, he has sort of kept them in exactly the same place, doing exactly the same thing, which is, I guess, what he was asked to do.
Sam says, having made negative Newcastle and Spurs teams look like free-flowing attacking forces, is there any team, past or present, Leeds couldn't make look fun to watch? That's quite a good point, isn't it? I mean, Saint-Maximin did look quite fun for Newcastle, but I tend to agree. It's hard most of the time. There was a really fun clip of a couple of Newcastle players just sort of ambling through a warm-up and just spanking the ball wide. Someone went, "How are you, lads? That's the warm-up done." It was quite funny. Premier League games tonight then. Chelsea Wolves, all eyes on Thomas Tuchel and his starting 11, which will obviously define who he loves and who he'll never pick for Chelsea again, all be decided this evening. Barney, you've written a bit on Thomas Tuchel, one of your lookalikes. Yeah, it's excited to have him in the Premier League.
Yeah, I mean, the more power and influence is put the way of kind of angular, slightly bug-eyed Germanic people, the better for all of us. I quite like him. There seems to be an urge to say that he's absolutely useless and a complete fraud for some reason. I don't really know where that's come from. People, there are always these kind of tribal currents that you pick up on. Like, why do people hate Thomas Tuchel? oh, it's sort of fans of some player who he didn't pick at some point, or is it people who don't like Germans or something? But the truth about Thomas Tuchel is that he's clearly quite a good manager who's done pretty well. He did pretty well at Dortmund, then fell out with everyone. He won a trophy. That's good. Some players there flourished under him, including Pulisic. He did pretty well at PSG. You know, he reached the Champions League final, won the cups he was meant to win. So he's obviously not a bad manager, or underqualified, or not very good at tactics. So we should give him a go. I think he's always been someone who's looked somehow ill-fitting in his environment wherever he's been. Even at Dortmund, he somehow managed to fall out with everyone. Where you'd have thought that would have been sort of a good place for him. So it'll be interesting to see if Chelsea, the place which routinely sacks managers at the rate of one a year, is the place where he finally finds a happy and stable home or not. But there's going to be so much hostility towards him. He's very lucky. I mean, I think he's very lucky there's not a crowd at Stamford Bridge. That will really help him. He's essentially going to have a series of practice matches to ease his team in the way... Arteta did during the sort of midsummer season. I'm really looking forward to it. That squad is really strong. He's coming in where he doesn't need to buy any new players, which is a really rare situation. It's a question of how do I make these incredible riches work, which will mean leaving people out of the team and so on. But his connection to the kind of Ralph Rangnick kind of connection to how do you make Timo Werner work seems promising. Rangnick also raved about Havertz when he was in playing against him, you know, setting up teams to play against him, called him the new Cruyff. So if he could just give Ralph a ring and have a long Zoom with him at some point in the next few weeks, I'm sure he can figure out how to unlock German power and German skill, because all Germans are the same and only Germans.
Well, that's can make Germans work. I loved that bit. Yeah, I was going to say that, Mark. You know, I love that everyone's gone, well, he must be best friends with Kai Havertz and Timo Werner because he's also German, as if all Germans are interchangeable and they all know each other. You know, it's like a tiny village in the home counties.
It's not just the Germanness. There is a kind of logic to it. But yeah, it is funny. And, you know, good old German. The Germans are here. We're fine now.
Mark.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is something in the way that sort of a generation of German coaches have come through and share a similar-ish philosophy, and therefore the players are coached in that kind of way. And that there has been accusations that Lampard's instructions on the press weren't very, German efficiency, really, in terms of how you're supposed to do it. And he was saying that they were running around not enough. Unlike Pep Guardiola, Frank Lampard wanted Chelsea players to run around more. And I think there was an accusation maybe from some of the Chelsea players that it wasn't they were running around not frequently enough, but it was more that they were doing it in a dumb way, and that they, you know, they needed somebody that could teach them how to press properly. And I saw that Kepa, in a lot of the deep dives that have sort of followed, Kepa was unhappy with the tactical instructions from Frank Lampard, which made me chuckle. I'm not quite
well,
sure.
Save it.
Yeah, I mean, he hasn't got to do that much other than catch it, save it, and kick it. I do think there is a method in bringing in somebody that I think is better suited to working with the very expensive talent that Chelsea have brought in over the summer.
I've been looking at Barney for the last 2 minutes trying to work out whether he does look like Tuchel or not.
There's Thomas Tuchel, there's Barney, there's Donald Tusk, and there's Mr. Burns. And they're in a kind of four, and it's where you put each one of them.
It's fine that you're all comfortable with this kind of casual racism towards Central European people. Yes, we all look the same. We all have a kind of quietly intellectual interest in the way things work. That's right.
Well, I've always had Tuchel down as sort of sickly Bond villain, the kind of one who's sat in a big dark auditorium with a massive screen of vectors in front of him, trying to work out how to sort of steal all of the oil in the world or something like that. So, whether you're capable of that, Barney, I don't know.
Well, maybe then we split. We can split Burns and Tuchel and Rone and Tusk, and they can go their separate look-alike ways. Now, we'll see what happens with Chelsea tonight. Five other games in the Premier League tonight. We'll talk about them on tomorrow's pod. Spurs play Liverpool on Thursday. Ben says, as a Spurs fan, why does it worry me more playing a Liverpool team winless in seven than it would playing a Liverpool team who'd won seven in a row? Since Monday's pod, Spurs won 4-1 at Wickham. And I thought, Mark, I just want to talk a bit more about Tanguy Ndombele. Like, he's like, the ball is an extension of his body, isn't it? It's miraculous. I know it was only Wickham, with all due respect to Wickham, etc. But, like, he's so great.
He is, yeah. And I think football comes so easy to him. He wants to do it now so that he's not looking when he's shooting. He's very proud of the fact that it was a no-look goal for his second effort. And there were various passes that where he was sort of looking the other way as he was sort of finding a teammate. The ball for Harry Kane that eventually led to the second goal, the chip with the inside of his foot, was a thing of absolute beauty. I mean, Wickham had barely trained due to COVID and the snow, and they'd put a lot into the first 65, 70 minutes. So the last thing they needed to see was somebody like Ndombele plus Son and Kane sort of coming on against those tired legs. But Ndombele has really stepped it up this season, and I'm still not sure what his best position is, but I don't think it really matters whether he plays deeper or, you know, closer to Kane. Just get him on the ball and have fun.
Yeah. Do you think he wants to do a whole game where he doesn't look at anyone he's passing to? At some point, he'll just do 90 minutes of no-look passes. Robert says, after watching the Wickham Spurs game, not sure I've seen a manager wear a leather jacket on the sideline. Grease lightning kept coming into my head every time the camera went on Gareth Ainsworth. I wonder if it had got T-Bird on the back. He's great, Barney, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he's a very popular guy, and people speak very warmly of him in football. But I always think it's a bit weird that he's the only manager who doesn't look like all the other managers. But everyone looks the same. They're all the same guy. And then there's one person who's wearing normalish clothes and has his own sort of, I think I'll wear a leather jacket. Why not? You know, there's no rules as a manager. You can wear anything. But
there are two, aren't there? You know, there's the very much, you know, I'm in a track, you know, there's the sort of Pulis, you know, coming down from Pulis in the tracksuit going one way, and then sort of coming down from, I guess, you know, Wenger in a suit, and they go their separate ways.
Yeah, you can wear a suit or a tracksuit, but you will go between the suit and the tracksuit. Those are two incarnations that are acceptable. And then one guy just happens to wear some vaguely normal clothes, and it's absolutely mind-blowing. I cannot believe what I'm seeing. It's extraordinary.
Where's Pep in that then? Because Pep's sort of casually dressed. But do you think I get the impression that that's Gareth Ainsworth just gone, I'll just stick this on. Whereas Pep's really thought about it, so it doesn't work as well.
Pep's cardigan cost £5,000. I mean, that's extremely formal casual wear. Isn't his wife dresses him, doesn't she? She's like a fashionista type person.
I didn't know that.
And so those trainers that look like they've come from sort of the, you know, Debenhams rack actually cost £20,000 and were designed by a seven-year-old Japanese boy, you know.
Also in the FA Cup, Bournemouth beat Crawley. Well done, Jack Wilshere. Scored his first goal since rejoining them. Lovely finish from the edge of the box. Well done, Jack. And that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll ask Sid Lowe if Barcelona really are bankrupt. Before we start part three, a note about a new podcast from The Guardian. On Wednesday the 27th, we're launching a new six-part series called Reverberate. The series explores incredible stories from around the world when music shook history. From the Siege of Leningrad to Cairo's Tahrir Square protest, each weekly episode uncovers the unique role music has played in framing social and political change around the world. The series begins with the tale of an English musician who became an overnight pop star in Hong Kong, only to discover he was the face of a huge new protest movement against China. Other episodes will look at how Manuel Noriega, the Panamanian dictator, got rickrolled, how one song about a local street helped forge a new identity for the South Asian communities of Birmingham, and scruffy Czech psychedelic rockers who took on the communist regime and won. Make sure you subscribe to Reverberate on Acast or wherever you get your podcasts. Now into part three, and to Sid in Spain. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Are Barcelona bankrupt, El Mundo in Spain? claiming that they're on the verge of bankruptcy. Let's ask Sid what's going on. Sid Lowe, how are you doing?
Well, hello. How are you? First things first, you've kind of asked the wrong person.
Right.
Because if what you're wanting is mathematical competence and financial expertise, you've definitely come to the wrong place. But the figures are very, very bad indeed. That said, one of the things that's really struck me looking at these figures is actually the extent to which these are not massively out of keeping with other big clubs. But it seems like all of Europe's big clubs have enormous debts. And so, for example, I've got the figures in front of me now. So Barcelona's total debt is 1.17 billion. Real Madrid's is 901 million. The net debt is 488 against 355. And the amount that they need to pay back in amortizations is 186 against Real Madrid's 173. So you see the figures there are not actually that far off each other. But Barcelona's situation is very, very bad, which I suppose in a way, look, we knew this anyway. The fact that this is a club that is trying in possibly the most embarrassing way imaginable, trying to weasel its way out of paying off Quique Setién, the last manager. This is a club that has been trying to sign Eric Garcia, but can't do so until the summer because they can't pay the, what would he cost, about 3 million, 4 million euros that he would cost to get him now. And a club that, as Koeman keeps saying very, very publicly as well, can't afford to buy any of the players that he keeps asking them to buy for him.
You know, I texted you last night going, is this new? Is this does this matter? Like, if lots of clubs have debt, I confess, I'm not an expert either, Sid. I don't know if anyone else is. It sounds like it does matter if it's actually impacting on
Exactly.
who they can't afford to get players. Because in your mind, you just think, well, Barcelona wants someone, they'll eventually get them because they're Barcelona.
Yeah, and so you look at a situation in which they are, that it impacts upon the things that they're trying to do daily. That, of course, matters and matters enormously. When you look at it in terms of the amount of money that they owe to other clubs, and they simply don't have that money at the moment. So, for example, they still owe, I think it's well over 30 million euros to Liverpool for Coutinho. There's a whole list of players that they owe money to. And one of them that really struck me was, you know, they still owe money for Malcolm, for example. So you get a player that comes, doesn't perform well or isn't given an opportunity to perform well, you sell him on, and yet, of course, 2 years on, you're still paying for him. And this can probably be embodied in terms of the kind of the combination of the financial and footballing disaster. This can be embodied, I think, as well as anything, by what Messi said about how they managed the Luis Suarez situation. And Messi himself was one who used the phrase madness. Barcelona, and regardless of whether or not we agree that they needed to move Luis Suarez on, but they basically paid off Luis Suarez's contract, basically covered all the money that they were going to pay him for the rest of his contract, didn't get any kind of transfer fee for him, thus allowing him to go to Atletico Madrid on a free transfer, although strictly speaking, it wasn't a free transfer because of the last minute kind of panic of realising that they were going to lose face. So they kind of came to this bizarre agreement where they have him for free, but you know, we'll put some objectives in place and maybe he can cost 2 million a year for the 2 years of his contract. And he goes to Atletico Madrid and he's top of the league and he's top scorer. So, you know, does this impact upon the footballing side of things? Yes, it does. I suppose the other question is whether this has an impact on them in terms of, does it risk them going out of business? Probably not, but they will need to completely restructure their debts. Now, will they find financial institutions to do so? Yes. They are already indebting themselves to be able to play the players even now. So, yeah, it's really bad, but not to the extent of them going out of business, I don't think.
You can't imagine Barcelona and Real Madrid sort of fading, right? But they've got to sort it out somehow. They need some money, right?
Well, I mean, Barcelona, obviously, look, Barcelona's case, and as I say, look, Real Madrid are not in brilliant financial shape, but there's a stability to them. And, you know, they haven't spent any money over this last year. And one of the reasons for that has been this financial structure. And of course, look, most of this debt is long-term and it's serviceable. And in Barcelona's point of view was, doesn't matter because we generate more money than anybody else. I think they became the first club to generate over €1 billion a year in terms of income. And that keeps going and it's fine. But of course, you get a pandemic at which a huge chunk of that just basically disappears in front of your eyes and it's not there. Now, that's not to say that Barcelona are only victims of the pandemic. They're victims of their own horrific mismanagement. And I think it's yet another demonstration of just how bad just Maria Bartomeu's presidency was. So what happens with this? I mean, I think what happens is, you know, in Barcelona's case, look, you've got presidential elections coming up on the 7th of March. They've already been put back because of the pandemic. They were supposed to happen, what date is it? Last weekend. And so what happens now, I guess, depends on who takes over. But all of them know, all the presidential candidates know that they will come in and they will have to restructure debt, find lines of credit, and almost certainly sell players. Now, they were having to do that anyway. And the problem, of course, is that that's not that easy. And go back to the Luis Suarez example. In the summer, Arturo Vidal, Ivan Rakitic, Luis Suarez, and I can't help feeling like I'm missing someone. Those three at least all departed, and they got 1.5 million euros in total for the three of them.
How's Lionel Messi?
Well, Messi, as you know, got injured. He's back tonight to play against Rayo Vallecano in the Copa del Rey. So I'll head down to Vallecas and maybe then I can report back on his happiness for you.
Vince asked you a question, by the way, Sid. When Sid served as an air filler before that Richard Keys interview 10 years ago, in the 15 minutes, did he cover one or two La Liga matches? This is after Jack Pitbrook's piece in The Athletic about, it was an anniversary since Sky got rid of Keys and Gray, and they did an interview on TalkSport, and you were they called you up because Richard Keys wasn't there to do his interview. Did you know you were filler at the time?
No, I had absolutely no idea. I had no idea at the time, and I had no idea since, or at least I don't remember having any idea since. And as you say, this piece that Jack wrote, Jack actually contacted me to ask him about this. I said, I did what now? I genuinely had no idea. He asked if I'd if there'd been some remark about me being, I can't remember the phrase, the greatest incidental warm-up act in history or something like that. I can't remember. And I certainly don't remember anyone ever having called me that or ever having called myself that. But apparently so. Although it is actually, I've mentioned this to Jack, and unfortunately it didn't go in the piece, but now I'm going to say it anyway. It's the second time I've completely unbeknownst done a huge warm-up act. I once warmed up for Gerry Adams, which was pretty bizarre without knowing it.
On TalkSport?
No, not on TalkSport, no. At a live event, I say a live event, the unveiling of a mural, and I was talking, and I was and it's quite disconcerting when you don't expect this. I'm talking, I'm thinking, God, that guy in the front row really looks like Gerry Adams. There's sort of a small gathering of people, not a huge amount of people. I think, oh, he really does look like Gerry Adams. Anyway, I finished talking, and the person who was kind of arranging the event said, and the next person to speak is Gerry Adams. Well, bloody hell. There you go. I was disappointed that his voice wasn't done by an actor. That was the only thing.
Did the mural have pictures of men in balaclavas holding rifles? I mean, did you get suspicious at any point?
No. I mean,
you're talking about...
No, it was a mural to honour Patrick O'Connell, who's an Irishman who was the manager of Real Betis when they won their only league title in 1935, who coached a handful of clubs, who played at Manchester United. And it's a lovely, lovely mural. And I was talking about him and about his league title win in Spain with Real Betis. And there were a handful of talkers. And the guy in the front row was a bit familiar.
Jack also got in touch with me about that piece and did quote, "The idea that on Soccer AM that Saturday, I wanted to have a full-size elephant in the studio that was never referenced." But unfortunately, like pretty much all my ideas on that show, it was not allowed in anyway. Listen, Sid, thanks so much for coming on.
It's a pleasure. Cheerio.
Sid Lowe out in Spain. From Spain to Italy, what a lively Italian derby in the quarterfinal of the Coppa Italia. Christian Eriksen won it in injury time. There was 10 minutes of injury time. You know, Zlatan got sent off. Him and Lukaku had a to and fro. Mark, it was frantic. It was quite fun, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, most of that 10 minutes injury time came about when the referee did his hammy, and it took forever to get off the pitch and take off all of his technology and pass it on to his assistant, during which time the commentators I was listening to were pondering whether he'd be fit for the weekend, which felt like a new obsession with referees. But it was a very, very interesting clash between the two clubs from Milan. And of course, it did center around that Lukaku and Ibrahimovic face-off, which saw them really square up to each other for a good minute or so, during which there were sort of insults traded, mainly from Ibrahimovic. Lukaku It's reported that Lukaku said to Ibrahimovic, you know, come and see me outside, to which Ibrahimovic said, well, bring your mum. And then very, very much sort of year seven, year eight sort of insults there. And then Ibrahimovic brought up a story, is said to have brought up a story that sort of from a couple of years ago when he said to Lukaku to go do his voodoo shit and also called him a little donkey. The voodoo stuff is, I couldn't remember the story at all, but Ibrahimovic has got a better memory than myself on Lukaku sort of matters, because this came about when he left Everton and the owner, Mashiri, he quoted in the Guardian sort of report on it, said, in the meeting, Rom called his mother. He said he was on a pilgrimage in Africa or somewhere, and he had a voodoo, and he got the message that he needs to go to Chelsea. Very odd story. Lukaku has denied it throughout, and of course he eventually went to United and played with Ibrahimovic. But unsavoury incident, I think it's fair to say. Although you said nobody likes to see it, I really liked seeing it and could have watched another couple of minutes of them squaring off. But it was eventually won by Eriksen in like the 98th minute, a lovely curling free kick. Afterwards, Antonio Conte said, nobody's leaving. So I don't know if that means Eriksen has to stay.
Zlatan also politely said, I'll fuck you and your wife. A strange thing to say to anybody, isn't it? Dave says, do you think the PGMOL, the FA, will reimburse Dean Smith's fine? Premier League referees have been given another round of guidance. It's our latest round of guidance. That sounds like a lovely meeting, doesn't it? On how to interpret one of football's most controversial laws following an outcry after Rodri winning the ball while he was apparently offside. Quote, where a player in an offside position immediately impacts on an opponent who has deliberately played the ball, the match officials should match officials should prioritise challenging an opponent for the ball, and thus the offside offence of interfering with an opponent by impacting on the opponent's ability to play the ball should be penalised. I mean, I zoned out while I was reading that. I don't know about anyone else.
That was amazing. I just wanted to say there is one thing about VAR in among all the incredibly boring things that people say. No offence. People have picked up that someone's going to get injured while we wait for the linesman to raise his flag. Like, because you keep playing, and worst of all, you keep playing with uncertainty in your mind. Is this real? What's going on? Is the flag going to go up? And it's when players are distracted and there's a slight mismatch in how hard you're going at the ball that people get injured. And this nearly happened last night. Saka kept playing. He went down the right wing. It was clearly offside, but they kept playing. And Saka was tackled quite roughly. I think he was half thinking he was offside, wasn't quite sure. Then it wasn't a foul because it was actually offside. I mean, if they injure Saka with VAR, I'm marching on Stockley Park. You know, there's some lines you don't cross. Nobody injures Saka. And if that were to happen, that we would have grounds for pulling VAR down like a Victorian statue and throwing it away, I think. But that will happen, and they need to sort that out, because playing on uncertain if whether this is real football or not is dangerous.
How do you do that? The assistant just doesn't raise the flag at all. They just don't bother, because...
Well, the real truth here is that you no longer need a linesman, or you no longer need someone with a flag, because there's this weird, are we dealing with humans or who's in charge
here? If they didn't have a flag, what would they hold? I mean... Well,
what's going to happen before long, and which could probably happen now, is that this is done by AI. We don't need a man with a flag. You could model this whole thing. This is what will happen. I know it sounds stupid, and like I'm going to start talking about 5G, but before long, you'll simply have a kind of GPS sensor in your shirt, and a machine will tell us when you're offside. That will happen in about 5 years, and we'll look at linesmen and say, what a ridiculous idea. A man with a flag is raising it in the air. And so that will happen. That's the end game.
Will robots do the podcasts or not? I'm thinking quite personally here.
Yes, and robots will be a lot better and a lot more reliable.
Report from the Telegraph that the government are increasingly likely to ban gambling firm sponsors on football shirts by the autumn, amid rising unease over betting addiction. So we'll follow that as it happens. Ipswich John says, can you get Nick Ames to give his thought on the situation at Ipswich Town after the local media reluctantly called for Paul, I've played for some massive clubs, Lambert's head? Nick?
Yeah, Yes, I will keep it short and concise. They've lost 6 home games out of 7 now, and I think 9 points from 10 or 10 points from 9, and I think 10th in League One, and a Lambert era that began fairly brightly in terms of goodwill anyway has utterly nosedived for many, many reasons that I won't spend half an hour going into. But the local newspaper, the East Anglian Daily Times, a former employer of mine actually, did a front page saying the manager must go on Sunday, which I know from people there, it took a lot of consideration and thought whether to do it. And now we've got to see whether Paul Lambert does get the boot. But what I'd say about that club is that in every single department, except for maybe the academy, standards have just slipped to a shocking level in the past sort of 10 years, 5 years especially. And we all have this thing with our childhood clubs and hometown clubs where everything seems a bit more dramatic and emotional close up, don't we? So it's probably the same here. But what's happened at Ipswich has been really, really bad. And they do, I think, need to make a change, although I'm not going to do a front page calling for a change. Because
I think the editor of The Guardian, it might be hard to swing that in the current climate. But, you know, listen, give it your best shot, Nick. In Paul Lambert's defence, early in lockdown, you know, when the Bundesliga returned, but we weren't, the Premier League wasn't back and everyone pretended to care about German football for a bit. We were told, I was on the radio and we were told that he was doing the co-coms of a game. I can't remember who was playing who. And so he came on the radio and we said, look, doing co-coms tonight for BT is Paul Lambert. We talked a lot about, you know, what it's like to co-commentate from your living room, you know, the Wi-Fi issues, all of that, what he thought about the game, etc. We said, thanks very much to Paul Lambert. He said goodbye. And then someone from BT got in touch to say, Paul Lambert is not doing co-coms on this game. But he very politely just answered all the questions without any point going, Owen Hargreaves is doing the co-coms. I don't know why you're asking me these questions. Pete says, how many vegetables does Mark think he consumed during Frank Lampard's spell as Chelsea manager? Does he think he'll consume more or less during Tuchel's time in charge?
It'll probably be a bore 0-0 draw, that one, Max, I would have thought.
So hang on, when did Lampard get the job?
Was it last summer? So was it
okay? 12, 16. So summer of 2019.
Yeah, I mean, I've probably eaten some carrots in that time, but not many. It'll probably be. I mean, Tuchel will be gone in about the same period that Lampard was there, so it'll be a draw. It'll be a 10-all draw.
I spend quite a lot of time trying to get one of my kids to eat vegetables because that suddenly seems to be something you have to do when you're a parent. And I have found a new method for doing this, which I recommend. I've become really good at making tuna mayonnaise sandwiches, and you can chop vegetables very finely. I put red onions, red cabbage, celery into the tuna mayonnaise, add loads of mustard and mayonnaise and a bit of olive oil, and toast it. You can even fry it, put cheese in it, make it incredibly calorific, but secretly you force them to eat healthy things. And it's just a recommendation.
Mark, what do you think?
I mean, that's always been my sort of, you know, when you see that the chef's doing sort of the, you know, the honey roasted carrots, and I sort of never really see the point of sort of that. I mean, like, the whole idea surely of eating the veg is that it's some sort of healthy intake. And yeah, of course, if you pour a load of sweet stuff onto it and a load of nice stuff, then they'll taste better. But you're having to eat sort of double the amount of unhealthy stuff to get the one of your 5 a day in.
I'm going to make you a sandwich and you're going to like it.
Oh, no, please do, Barney.
Okay, well, it feels like a good time to finish. Barney Ronnie, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Max. Bye, everyone.
Thank you, Nick.
Thank you, Max.
The Racing Post's Mark Langdon, thank you.
See you, Max.
We'll be back tomorrow.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.